The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day. Better still, join SupChina's Access program for lots of bonus materials, steep discounts on our conferences and our live shows, and membership on our SupChina Access Slack channel, where you can talk China with our staff, our readers, and our listeners, and take part in weekly live conversations with special guests. I am Kaiser Guo. I am coming to you today from the sidelines of the Association for Asian Studies Conference in Washington, D.C. I regret to say, terribly disappointed that David Moser, who had originally planned to be in town for the conference, wasn't able to make it. Originally, he was going to co-host this episode, along with Jeremy Goldcorn, while I just manned the controls, but as fate would have it, it's just me. Jimmy, that arch pianza, claims to be on vacation, but actually he is, I'm going to reveal to you, back home in Nashville, Tennessee, working on his latest stupendous feat of charlatanism, which I think involves building a megachurch on his land in Goldcorn Holler, where he plans to fleece unsuspecting, God-fearing Americans of their hard-earned money with a theology shamelessly cribbed from Hong Xiuquan and his Taiping doctrine. He's going to deliver sermons in that slickly charming Anglo-South African accent of his, and shame on him, shame on him. Anyway, today on Seneca, we are going to talk about the Pianzi Jinyi's Ming Dynasty forerunners in the art of the grift, as well as how hucksterism and its unscrupulous practitioners have ebbed and flowed in the centuries since, seems appropriate in this time when in China one feels like one must maintain real vigilance against increasingly sophisticated scams, and when here in the U.S. the whole damn country was conned in 2016. Joining us are two gentlemen who have translated Zhang Yingyu's Book of Swindles into English. Christopher Ray is an associate professor of Asian studies at the University of British Columbia, UBC. He is the author of the book The Age of Irreverence, which is a companion volume to Evan Osnos's The Age of Ambition and to Xi Jinping's The Age of Xi Jinping. Welcome to Seneca. You are very long overdue, Chris.
Thanks for having me here.
Also joining us is Bruce Rusk, associate professor of pre-modern and early modern China, also at UBC, and he's former president of the Society for Ming Studies. It is actually Ming Madness Month, isn't it?
It's always Ming Madness.
Well, Bruce, welcome to Seneca. Really great that you could make it here. So, Chris, first to you, who was Zhang Yingyu, and when did he live? What else is he actually known to have written or to have done?
Well, we know more about when he lived than who he was.
Uh-huh.
He lived in the 16th to 17th century, thereabouts, but we don't know very much about his background. Some people say he was from Zhejiang, some people say he was from Fujian. If you actually read the one book that we know that's attributed to him, it says different things in the preface from in the text itself. So he's a very murky character. There are some textual clues that he might have been from the south, from Fujian, because he uses some Fujianese dialect and slang terms. But we really can't tell too much more than that, except that he had a lot of sympathy for merchants, for the businessman on the road.
Well, if he's from Zhejiang, then yeah, of course that makes sense.
That's right.
That attests to either province.
Right, it's like Tennessee down there.
Bruce, do you have any clues or a speculation as to, do you lean either way, Zhejiang or Fujian?
The compromise would be to say that he was a Zhejiang man who lived in Fujian, and he probably lived most of his life in Fujian because there's so much Fujian language there, Minnan.
And what about this time that he lived in? I mean, maybe you can paint a picture of China in the time of the early 17th century, I suppose, is when he wrote. Bruce, you want to?
Sure. It's a very flourishing commercial economy. The world trade that connects China to Europe, even to the Americas, through silver coming from mines in Mexico and South America, is making people rich quickly. But that's also changing the social order, because the old status symbols, the old stratifications of society are falling apart. People can't rely, for example, on seeing somebody wearing fancy silk and knowing they must be from an elite hereditary family.
Right.
They could have just bought that yesterday. And this new wealth is making it really difficult to tell who you can trust, and people are moving around a lot more than before.
Well, that is the first of many descriptors that I think are going to echo. I mean, that are going to have a lot of similarities to the society that we're living in today or have been for the last couple of decades. So, okay, social change going on, absolutely. The Columbian Exchange really kind of upending the whole commercial order in so many ways. All that silver coming from Potosí. So it was a time then of swindlers, of con men, right? This was a time when they kind of flourished and they were particularly commonplace.
Yeah, it seems like the way to wealth was not just landowning anymore, right? Having a major estate. You wanted to actually go hit the road and do some commerce. You get a lot of stories in Zhang Yu's collection about somebody who's taking a load, you know, several bolts of silk down south, or is just made a packet down in Guangdong selling some other commodity and is on his way home. And that, whether he's on the road or whether he's on a boat, you know, he's a mark.
Uh-huh.
So he's got to watch out.
So what do you suppose Zhang Yiyu's intention was in writing this? I mean, so who's he actually writing it for? And was the Book of Swindles supposed to inoculate people against these sorts of hucksters? Or was he just writing to entertain people? Because, you know, it actually is very entertaining.
It's a lot of both. The preface, which was written by someone else, will tell you that he was a wise Confucian gentleman who is warning you about these dangers.
Uh-huh.
And the stories themselves sometimes contain morals that tell you how to avoid a trap like this. But if you read it carefully and you read his notes that he adds to the end of every story, a lot of the times he's actually delighted and marveling at the ingenuity of the scammers.
Right.
So you also get the sense that he may have sometimes sided with them because this was a battle of wits and whoever came out on top deserved it.
Now, the other side of the coin for the Confucian gentleman who so values intellect, right?
Exactly.
Is this, Chris, similar in any ways to some of the other literature that came out at around the same time? I mean, I'm thinking about, for example, the scholars, Ruling Meister. I hear some echoes of it. And also, what's the language that it was written in? Is this in Guinyin or is this in Baihua, kind of like the other Ming novels of the time?
Yeah, it's all in Wenyin.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, even the dialogue is essentially in a version of Wenyin.
In there classical Chinese.
Yes, in
right,
classical Chinese.
Know, right.
Right. And so it's different from, you know, you find stories about tricksters in Feng Menglong's famous stories or Ling Mengchu's stories, or a lot of big story collections written in vernacular Chinese, you know, more like people speak, about bags dropped by the side of the road and someone picks it up. Then someone else comes out and it's like, hey, that's my bag. You know, let's split the silver in it. But it turns out to be filled with lead or something else. So you have similar stories like that. And then, yeah, hundreds of years later, you know, in Qing novels like The Scholars, you do get similar scenarios. Or in other Ming novels like Plum and the Golden Vase, you also get procuresses and go-betweens and all these shady characters.
Between the sex scenes, right?
Oh, yes, between the sex scenes. Well, you can swindle for sex as well as for money. And so there's plenty of that going
on here,
too. In this
book, too, yeah, yeah, lots of sex.
Yeah. But it's a unique collection partly because of the language. And it's a language that's not extremely complex and with tons of allusions. So maybe your average merchant, man on the street, could pick it up and learn some lessons from it.
And how did it come down to us? How is it preserved?
Well, we don't know exactly. It was printed in about 1617, the first edition, and very few copies survived at all. But it became quite widespread in Japan. It was popular there. It was translated and selected in Japanese editions. And a few copies that survived in Western libraries and in Japan were then reprinted in the late 20th century.
Was it at some point actually banned? Did they go after it? For example, after the Qing conquest, was this extirpated deliberately?
Not that we know of. It doesn't seem to have risen to the level of some of the other novels, actually, like Plum in the Golden Vase, which could be banned as lascivious, but it was just ignored as far as we can tell, except for the people who cribbed from it.
So it's a bit of a mystery. And you mentioned The Scholars, and there's a story in The Scholars that is very similar to one you find in the Book of Swindles, where in this Scholars version, someone has been taken to court for murder. So this man says, this monk murdered my father. but it turns out he means a cow, and that it's a monk who's been going around duping people by pretending that their livestock are his reincarnated parents. And the way that he convinces them that they're his reincarnated parents is because when the animal sees them, it comes over and starts licking him on over his head and his body. And they're like, it turns out he's been smearing salty brine on his skin. So it seems like, you know, familial affection.
People do that with peanut butter now for their dogs.
Right? Exactly. In the Book of Swindles, the guy gets away with it. And in the scholars, they don't. But that's, you know, a 100-year gap. So these stories were certainly out there.
This is the thing with you, Chris. How did the two of you first become interested in this particular text? I mean, because I know you're one of the Anglophone world's leading experts on the Chinese funny bone. So in your case, was it the humor in these stories that drew you to the text and impelled you to undertake this massive translation? Or was it something, you know, sort of more purely scholarly?
This is definitely the most fun translation project I've ever done. And it was a fantastic collaboration. I think it was partly because when I've been studying, you know, humor and laughter in like early 20th century China, there are all these stories about how Shanghai is a place you don't want to trust anybody. Huh. Like if you're coming from the countryside, you got to watch out for those slippery Shanghai types. And you know a little something about regional stereotypes.
I do. I mean, like being Hunanese myself, I mean, I guess Hunan is the new Shanghai.
Right. Well, maybe. But, you know, or you could say, you know, Canada is less shady than the U.S. Because, right, you know, the further south you get, then essentially the more shady things are. But there are a lot of stories in like the 1920s about Shanghai's world of swindlers. You have books with titles like this, 4-volume collections of swindle stories. And so I became curious about how, if there are any earlier versions of these stories, how these archetypes were formed. And I was also, there are a lot of stories about kind of funny trickster figures, uh-huh, becoming culture heroes. And it's like, why do we need trickster heroes in 20th century Shanghai? So when Bruce mentioned the Book of Swindles to me, like, that sounds fascinating. I've never heard of this work. And it turns out that actually a lot of Ming Dynasty literary experts haven't heard of this work either. So it's a huge mystery about like why it disappeared from the literary record for about 400 years.
So Bruce, how did you come on to the text? I mean, how did you discover it?
Well, I've been interested in fakes and how people detect forgeries and detect charlatans for a long time. And I was particularly interested in silver. And that, of course, was the main form of money in the late Ming, that people didn't, for the most part, carry out big transactions in coins. They use lumps of silver, ingots, yeah, yuanbao. And inside this text, there's quite a lot about the mechanics of transactions with silver and how people looked at a piece of silver and decided if it was to be trusted or not, just the same way you have to decide if a person is to be trusted or not. So I was really interested in it from that point of view, translated a few of the stories actually to use in class, in teaching with undergraduates, and found students really loved them.
Yeah.
This window onto the society. And so kept those sort of going and talked to Chris, and we decided to translate more of it.
So there are a total of some 80-odd stories in there, and you guys translated 40 or so. First of all, how did you select which ones to do? And then secondly, the organization of them, is that native to the book? Are they actually in the original text? Is it organized by type of swindle? Or is this something that you guys decided to do?
Yeah, it's the categorization is one that Zhang Yu himself came up with.
Okay.
Or maybe an editor, maybe someone at the press. But it does seem like the author had a role in it. And so he's taken this category of swindle and divided it into, you know, misdirection and theft, the bag drops, money changing, false relations. He has a whole section on brokers, another one on women, marriage scams, gambling, and so on and so forth. And so we wanted to have at least one story from each section. But we each did a pass and a read through and see which ones also stood out as the most entertaining or interesting,
right,
to us. And so we wanted to kind of represent the spirit of the work. There's some stories that are repetitive, so we cut some of those out.
Uh-huh.
But we also wanted to show some of the outliers, as you know, some of the more outrageous stories.
Bruce, are these presented by Zhang Yu as fiction or as factual or something maybe in between?
They're kind of in between, like a lot of Chinese fiction, which is modeled on history. So they often start off with saying such and such a person lived in such and such a place, and one day this happened. And that can be the pattern in a lot of historical biographical writing, but it's also the pattern of a lot of fiction writing. And so the line was kind of blurry. But I think people definitely took them as fiction at the time. I think there was certainly an awareness that most of the figures in them, although a few are real historical figures and some of these anecdotes circulate elsewhere, most of them are made up people because they're also from a very low level of society, ordinary merchants that we wouldn't hear about otherwise.
So that's interesting because, you know, this guy is obviously, or he's portrayed as some sort of Confucian gentleman, and he goes among the lumpen, right? He goes among he talks to people of quite low class, maybe not all the way down to the actual mendicant, but to pretty, you know, sleazy kind of huckster merchant types and to, you know, traders and to peddlers, right?
Yes, well, he's also perhaps from this class of the Confucian merchant, the Rushang, who can be in between, who can both have to deal with the everyday business of business and also make the pretense that they're an educated man.
So Zhang actually appends a lot of commentary really to each of the stories. What can we glean about the source of his ethics? Are they your basic sort of Ming, I guess it would be, you know, Neo-Confucian, Zhuxi kind of Neo-Confucian ethics? Or does he have some sort of other ethical standard that he seems to throw these up against?
Well, he definitely tips his hat to Confucius and Mencius, and he seemed to be a big fan of the Book of Changes, which I'll let Bruce talk about because he's an expert in that. But some of his sentiments are kind of predictable and moralizing, we should condemn crime. You know, thank you very much. Okay, well done. But sometimes, he says, well, really, the dupe was at fault. Like, this was a bad situation. Anyone could have told at a glance. You do not mix with that type of person. You keep your silver hidden. You don't mix it in the same box with him. And so he condemns their stupidity sometimes.
Victim blaming.
Yeah, so there's a lot of that. But he's also like trying to give practical advice. So a lot of times he gives like really specific recommendations about when you travel, you should have an attendant with you, right? So that if you get drunk at that banquet, they can wake you up. If, you know, there's one where the guy gets thrown overboard and drowns, but fortunately the other guy didn't have as much to drink and is able to save some of the situation, if not his master.
Well, the thing that I'm most interested in, since this is a podcast about current affairs, what does this tell us about, you know, what's happened in recent decades? I mean, we can see the relevance of the book to the age that we now live in. I mean, anyone can. Can you talk about, let's all sort of do this as a kind of mental exercise. What are the characteristics of a society that make it an age of charlatanism? And I don't think it's something that's particularly Chinese necessarily. I think, I mean, reading through it, I kept picking up on things. It's like, you know, this is an awful lot like X time. And I think probably anyone who's familiar with American history will zero in immediately on the period after the Civil War, after 1865, and what has, you know, memorably come down to us as the Gilded Age, which was, this is actually something that Evan Osnes pointed out to me years ago, just the incredible parallels when just the river was just swimming with these snake oil salesmen. I mean, literal snake oil salesmen, right? That's when snake oil first started being sold as sort of this panacea, right? I just finished reading Ron Chernow's biography of Ulysses S. Grant, who, of course, you know, he lived during that time. Obviously, he was, you know, the great general who accepted the Confederate surrender at Appomattox. What was it about that time, though, that made him so susceptible? He was duped again and again and again. I mean, flat-out Ponzi schemes where he lost it all. I mean, he was, like, absolute penury after his presidency. What is it?
One big factor is you have to deal with strangers all the time. You're in a city often, but not necessarily. You could just be on the road, and the road conceptually is not just the road, but also, of course, the canals and the lakes too.
The Jianghu.
Exactly, Jianghu. And Jianghu appears in the title of the book, the full title.
Oh, it does.
So it's very much set in that realm.
Let's unpack that word a little bit. There are some people who don't know what the Jianghu is. Chris, this is a hard one to translate, right? Jianghu. How do you typically translate the word Jianghu?
Very good question. I think that you could do it a couple ways. Literally, you know, rivers and lakes. And so it's kind of a geographic marker, but it's also an aquatic metaphor, right? It's this place of like flow and kind of watery, fluid realm. It's probably best known for being related to the kind of wuxia,
the martial arts,
the martial arts epics and dramas and chivalric romance of in Chinese style.
It's a world of the wine shops. Where the heroes meet each other, and there's always that fight that involves like deft use of bowls and chopsticks in the kung fu movies.
Exactly. Right. They're all meeting either on the road or at an inn or at these kind of transient way stations.
The caves where they're given some ancient Buddhist scripture that teaches them, you know, some new martial technique. What else is there? I mean, there's the market square where they do the combat. There's the you know, high mountaintops where there's this sacred temple. Right. Yeah. It's like Dungeons and Dragons, right? I mean, there's that the milieu of right.
Then people are trying to figure out who the other person is. Like, is this guy on my side? Is he on the other side? Is he like, you know, a brother of the green wood? you know, is it a fellow Hao Han, or is he an evil nemesis in disguise?
And you create these kind of fictive, these imaginary kinship relations because you're not with your real family. You don't have an actual home to rely on, but you create temporary brotherhoods. And here in these stories, it happens all the time that two travelers are on the road together. They're both in the same line of work or they're from the same province in foreign parts. And they have to decide whether they're going to trust each other and rely on each other's protection. And that's an easy way to get duped as well.
I've often used scene as a way to sort of like, you know,
for because,
yeah, Jianghu these days, I mean, in the modern context. So we talk about, for example, the internet business, sort of the internet startups and venture capital. That is a Jianghu. The rock and roll scene that I was a part of, that was a Jianghu. And, you know, I often get a laugh and when people ask me what I'm doing, I'll just regarding music, I'll say, we can twish with Jianghu. I've
retreated left it from behind. Right. Of course, professors prefer not to think of ourselves as being in an denizens ivory tower, but rather on the Shishu Jianghu, like on the academic rivers and lakes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Like we are now here in DC.
Exactly. This is it. This gathering of uber Asian.
But it's kind of like the wide, wide world, you know. It's like out there. It's away from home.
So that's one definite element of it. And, you know, this doesn't exist in the village, right? This is when, as Bruce, as you said, when it you're in a period of societal flux. Yeah?
Yes, and on many different scales, including from hour to hour, one of the contexts that comes up a lot here is literally on the rivers and lakes in boats. A lot of the time, people are traveling from place to place. People are coming onto the boats, going off, and that's an opportunity you have to very quickly come to a judgment. Is this person reliable or not? And that can include the captain of the boat as well as your fellow passengers.
It's funny that you should mention river boats, right? I mean, in the context of what we
Absolutely.
Were just talking about, right? Mark Twain. Life on the Mississippi. And then, you know, all of his writings about the Gilded Age, a lot of that also transpires on riverboats, yeah?
Yeah, well, it's the perfect place to commit this kind of crime because they're constantly stopping and starting. If you're on an ocean liner and you steal something, you're stuck. But if you're on a riverboat, you just hop off at the next port, which might only be an hour or two down the Mississippi or down the Yangtze, and you can get away with it.
That's fascinating. Okay, so we've got that sort of motility, that mobile kind of environment, and we've got that societal change. What about technology? Does that maybe play a part in it? What is not even necessarily like, you know, technology in the sense that we think of it now, but maybe institutional technologies?
There are a few things that come to mind. One of the key, really interesting windows this text gives, these stories give us, but it's probably going on more widely, is the technologies of trust. If you think of the kind of things we have to do now to make, say, a currency trustworthy and to make a transaction trustworthy online, some of the same issues were coming up in this society where people were having to make large purchases and put things in escrow, go through a broker. And so there were ways, for example, of sealing up a box of silver ingots so that you knew the money was there, but you couldn't actually withdraw it until the transaction was done, that you'd gotten the goods. So there were all kinds of technologies
sort
for making
wax seal-based escrow, right?
Yeah, actually, I think paper seals, and they were stamped with what we call a chop, and that told you the money was there, it was intact, unless somebody found a magical way of removing it, which some of these stories involve.
Right.
But that was a big problem, was knowing the person had the money and that you would actually get it at the end of the day.
Sounds like Bitcoin today, right. or all these cryptocurrencies. Yeah, I was just watching that. You know, John Oliver has that show last week night, which is just hysterically. I was watching this segment on the hype around cryptocurrencies, and I had been reading the book and was just stunned at how similar these societies are. So yeah, I mean, I think in a society where there are major technological changes and some people are ahead of the curve on them and they are able to. What about this whole phenomenon of sort of fear of missing out and just that naked greed that people that makes everyone like General Grant susceptible to these guys? FOMO, big phenomenon in today's society. Do you think that it had its analogy back in 17th century Ming China?
Well, there's definitely a lot of stories that involve the convincer, as one historian of like the American Confidence Man put it, where you stimulate someone's greed by giving them a little incentive. You give them a little money as a sweetener, and then they go all in with you, and then you can really take them. So, you know,
the Nigerian 419 scam, right.
Yeah, so it does have a lot of late Ming iterations of someone says, oh, my dad fell in with some thieves and they buried a lot of silver on your farm, help me dig it up, and oh, look, here's one, which of course you've planted there yourself. And then he, you know, that's how he gets in with this guy and they become confederates and he scams them.
The other place where there's a big fear of missing out is in the civil service exams, which how you make your...
Very time sensitive.
Right. Yes. And you make your way to the next echelon of society if you actually pass the exams, or you buy your way in by bribing the right person. And so a lot of the scams involve convincing someone that they are able to bribe the examiners, even if they can't. So the... they make a show of meeting with the examiner. In fact, it's not even the examiner.
It's somebody posing as.
Posing as the examiner. Right. But there's that fear that if you don't pass, then you're not just you, but your whole family will lose out for generations to come.
And so that's a very vulnerable community. And often the fact of bribery is kind of taken for granted. And he condemns it. Zhang Yu condemns it. But that's never the swindle. Like the swindle is not the bribing the examiner. The swindle is how that money is taken away by some intermediary, even to the extent of some gang like Pools or Capital buys like an inn and buys a wife for one of them and servants so that they can set up this elaborate, seemingly legitimate business to lure exam candidates in. And then another Confederate comes along and tries to do this bribery scam in the inn. And the innkeeper says, you know, leave your money in my safe instead. And as soon as they do that, they take it out of the back and flee.
We've given a lot of little examples, but let's tell a whole story or two. I mean, I think maybe if each of you can select one that you can do a quick kind of potted vernacular retelling of. Bruce, why don't you tell us what's one of your favorite stories from the book?
So one of my favorite stories is the street sweeper who gets a lucky marriage. He's this impoverished street sweeper in the capital, probably Nanjing, and he is so poor that there's no chance he could possibly afford a wife because there was it was costly to have a wedding.
Yeah, that is now.
Exactly. But somehow this woman shows up who's a recent widow and takes a shining to him and stays at his house, and they're very quickly married, and she has means of her own. She has a little bit of money that she kept from her marriage, and they start a family. But very quickly, it turns out that she's actually scamming him. What she does is send him to buy cloth so she can make some clothes to sell for a little bit of income. And when he brings it home, she cuts it short and says, this store, they tricked you. They gave you a short piece of cloth. Take it back. He does. The store is upset, but it processes the return. And then she secretly pokes holes in it. And he has to go back again. And the store is much more upset this time and beats him up. And he ends up so badly beaten that she, in the course of trying to nurse him back to health, gives him wine and gets him tipsy and then suffocates him. And he dies seemingly of the wounds inflicted by the store employees.
Right.
So she's set it up to look like this man has been killed by the shop that was fleecing them. But in fact, she was staging the whole thing. Then she goes to court and sues the storekeepers for
wrongful death,
death, essentially, or actually wants an out-of-court settlement so that they don't have to go to court for murder. And eventually they have to agree to it, and she suddenly disappears with the money.
And once again, she's a widow with a recent widow with some means, right? So lather, rinse, repeat, right?
Yes, although interestingly, Zhang Yiyu thinks, although he doesn't seem to know the full inside scoop, that she is actually the wife of a big crook. This is the term he uses. Gun, which literally means a stick, but it's the term he uses for all the criminals,
right,
in the story. And she's not even a real widow. She's actually the wife of a swindler who is set up to...
That's a long con, though. She actually goes through the trouble of having a family with this guy. And I mean, she waits that long to start... Wow. Amazing. So I note that this is one of many villains who happen to be women. What is going on with that? I mean, obviously, traditional China is deeply sexist, but it seems like a disproportionate number of the villains in this are women. Is that correct, Chris?
I'd say it's a minority, but okay. They're definitely there. They're definitely well represented. And some of the more popular stories, like the ones you find in other collections, do involve women. That you find, 400 years later. So, they are represented. They often involve sex or some kind of sexual enticement. But sometimes, like, they wanted meat or oil, like basic commodities. And then one woman convinces her relative to essentially go into prostitution to keep this thing going. So the victims as well as maybe a quarter of the story, something like that. Involve women as kind of protagonists.
Oh, so Chris, can you top Bruce's story?
Can I top? I do think there is like a logic of one-upsmanship in these.
It's
kind of like jokes, but, the one I was thinking of is different because it's more like a serial scam.
Where
it also involves bribery around the examinations.
Oh, good.
Right. So, and this is supposedly a true crime story, like based on actual events from the year 1600, where there were a bunch of people in this county in Fujian who had passed the first and second levels, like the provincial exams. And so they were going to all go to the capital to take the top ranking ones.
Right.
And when they all leave, some Xiuqai, like the guy at the lowest level, works with a crook to forge letters ostensibly from their teacher. So they had all like had the same master or teacher who educated them, saying, I had this auspicious dream where I dreamed that your son placed first. And, so he recounts this letter and he actually includes a letter. He said, I actually saw one of these letters from one of these people.
And here it is.
And so he like copies the whole thing. But they would go around to every household and pretend to be from Master Shen and spread the good news. And then they would get like a consideration, a tip from the delighted family members. And they say, we have to go like put on a show and go to all of your classmates' houses. But it's just for show, right? You're the only one. Right. And so, but the interesting thing is Zhang Yiyu's comment at the end where he says he pulled off this remarkable swindle of the painless scam. Because even though all of these rich families, paid them some money and they netted a fortune,
they felt happy
for for several months until everybody failed and came back home. And there's even a study showing that this good news scam was still going on over 100 years later in the Qing Dynasty.
I think that that's the basis of just about every palm reader and every tarot reader. I mean, that you just sell people on the good news. That's how it works. A lot of similarities. Have you guys studied contemporary scams in China? Have you looked at anything that has close parallels to what was happening in the Ming Dynasty now in the time of reform and opening? Or I guess that period has come to a screeching end, but... Bruce?
Well, I haven't myself, but people certainly recognize that parallel in as early as the early 90s. And there's an edition of the Book of Swindles in Chinese that was published with a Baihua, modern vernacular translation.
Uh-huh.
And for each story, or at least for most of the stories, a contemporary parallel where there was a similar swindle that might have taken place on the Shenzhen stock market, for example, after the original story from the Ming Dynasty.
Oh,
so
that's,
people definitely
that's great.
Have seen that.
Okay, so yeah, I want to check out that edition. That'd be a lot of fun. I mean, because, you know, the parallels are just too striking. I mean, on most of these things, I think you could come up with a modern version of them. I mean, people's basic nature doesn't seem to have changed that much. You could substitute in, instead of the civil service exam, the good old Gaokao. I mean, and you could probably, you know, manage the same thing. You guys have both probably spent a little bit of time in Taiwan, have you? Both of you have? Yeah, yeah. And in recent years, one thing that really impresses me is that the place is just such a palpably high trust society. But it most certainly wasn't like that always. I mean, in the, you know, the Pianza types in Taiwan used to abound as well. In fact, I think, you know, a lot of people think they all went left and went to the mainland. In recent years, you've seen some of the big rings that have been busted. For example, the ones that will call you up and tell you about your bank account having been hacked and, you know, owing all this money, and then, you know, walking you through all the processes. It turns out that those people, the masterminds, were from Taiwan. But my question is, what makes a society go from a low trust one in which, you know, swindlers abound to a high trust one where they have a great deal more difficulty actually making inroads? Or is a high is it cyclical? Is a high trust society vulnerable in its own way to swindlers?
I think it probably is cyclical, because one of the issues is new technologies, especially information ones, are initially useful for swindlers, and eventually people get the hang of them. So at least I'm hopeful that one day, at least some of the simpler internet scams will no longer work. You won't be able to make so much money off pop-up ads claiming to sell you a
penis enlargement. Or
exactly.
Well, that's always going to work.
But there was no Google in... well, there's still no Google in China, but there was also no Baidu in the Ming Dynasty. And so one of the issues is, how do you check up? How do you figure out if someone is legit or not? And there was simply no mechanism for doing that, other than things like listening to someone's accent to figure out that they're probably from the same province as you are, and therefore they're probably trustworthy in a relationship with you. It's not a general trust, but it's a particular relationship.
Not if they have my co-provincial accent, then it's no, the Hunanese, right? Who were the Hunanese of the day, though? I wonder, in Fujian, nowadays you go to Beijing and everyone says, you know, they make the jokes about my people, about, you know, 千万不要相信河南人. Was there an ethnic group or a particular province or a particular geography that was blamed for this?
And definitely most of the stories take place in Nanjing or places south.
Uh-huh.
But I would say you have probably more occupational hazard. Like, certain occupations trend more towards deception, certainly.
Right.
Brokers, courtesans, prostitutes, you know, people in intermediary roles or in very... very transactional ones, or given to betray trust, or low, like yamen runners, right? Low government officials.
Right.
And people in the, what we might call the transportation industry. So there were no taxi drivers, but
porters.
There were, yeah, porters, sedan chair bearers,
boatmen,
all not to be trusted.
God.
One curious thing about Zhang Yu's collection, which I think deserves further research, is it came out around the same time that you had a lot of picaresque novels in Spain.
Uh-huh.
Or
actually,
El Buscón, like The Swindler. There was a novel published around the same time, the first part of Don Quixote, you know, featuring this delusional character who keeps being tricked on the road. All these stories seem to be coming out around the same time. So I wonder if silver was part of the connection, or in that case, there's a lot about, you know, the chivalric romance. So kind of a Spanish Jianghu imaginary going on, and making people actually take to the road. So I think there's some interesting resonance.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, and it fits the pattern that we were talking about. I mean, what historians these days like to use the year 1500 really as sort of the dividing line between, you know, the medieval world and the modern world, right? And 1500, yeah, I mean, absolutely. That it was a really transitional period, where I think you have that change in social structures, you have the emergence of this, you know, strong burger class and all across Europe and in parts of Asia as well. Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting.
Haiyan Li at Stanford University wrote a really interesting book about strangers and Chinese attitudes towards strangers. And she does talk a lot about the idea of the Jianghu, where some of these people who find kinship outside the home are, you know, are sworn brothers, but everybody else is kind of fair game. That's like one type of ethical attitude that has resulted in a lot of mistrust.
Right.
But I do think in Zhang Yu's day, society was changing very quickly. You have a lot of popularity of these types of stories in the early 20th century where there is very poor governmental controls. And I guess you could say that maybe one of the reasons you also see a big boom in these types of swindle story collections in the 1990s and early 2000s is this kind of, let's all get rich first, and like all the regulation and the controls are going to catch up in due course.
Yeah, that's a very important feature of times like that. What about the role of law enforcement in these periods? What do the cops do, the magistrates? I mean, how are they brought into this? And are they themselves corrupt? Are they themselves often used as part of the swindle?
They're absolutely and profoundly corrupt. That's one of the base assumptions, especially the clerks, the low-level employees,
sure,
but even the magistrates often. And even when they're not corrupt, they're incompetent. That's one of the defining features of this book, because strikingly, it actually is a lot like a genre from the same time, the sometimes called detective stories, the Gong'an Xiaoshuo, stories of Judge
Di. Or court case fiction, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many of them actually are court cases.
Di and Jie, Judge Di. These were made famous in English by Robert Van Gulik.
Yes.
Who translated a lot of them. They're set in the Tang Dynasty, actually, but they were actually written in the Ming. Is that right?
Yes. And he translated them, and then he liked them so much, he wrote a bunch more of his own.
Right, right. And, you know, I think they fit well. The original ones are pretty good.
Absolutely.
Heard they were going to make a movie out of that. Whatever happened to
they
that?
They did.
They have.
Oh, they did?
It's like Young Judge D, too.
Yeah.
I mean an English language movie.
Oh, yes.
A friend of mine named Peter Lower was working on that some years ago. I think they had introduced some Scottish character that was weird because, you know, you have the white savior or whatever. But I don't know if that ever got made. Those are great stories. And often they involve him unmasking swindlers, right?
Absolutely. In this collection, though, it's kind of the opposite. One of the other famous judges, Judge Bao, shows up in one of these stories.
Bao Gong.
Yes, Bao Gong.
Bao Qingtian is his name.
Exactly.
He's the black-faced guy with a moon on his forehead.
He was always brilliant, you know. He always cracks the case in the old stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In this one, though, the opposite happens. Someone actually manages to pull one over him.
Over on Judge Bao, wow.
Yes, and the way he does it is by knowing Judge Bao's psychology extremely well. So it's a clerk in the court who is paid off by a rich young man who has been accused of a crime and is supposed to be flogged in the court. And the clerk instructs the young man to plead for mercy. And the clerk then says, "You will get no mercy." And Judge Bao is upset at the clerk for making this decision that the judge should be making. And
reverse psychology or whatever, right?
Exactly. He transfers half of the punishment from the perpetrator
to the clerk.
And the clerk knew this would happen and accepted the payment. And of course, he knew also that his colleagues, the other clerks, wouldn't beat him so hard as they would a real criminal. So he got off lightly too, and he made some money off it.
Right.
And Judge Bao was none the wiser.
Yes.
So Judge Bao was an actual historical character? I've never actually, you know, thought about him. I watched the TV series when I was a kid, but...
Yeah, if I recall, he was a Song Dynasty magistrate.
Oh, right. Song Dynasty magistrate. Oh, so, okay. So some of these stories actually are taken from previous historical times then, right? Or many of them are.
Well, it's an interesting collection in that it's clearly drawn from a bunch of different sources. There are a minority of the stories where you can like actually trace it to some biography of a historical personage. Some, like the Judge Bao one, you know, probably made up, right? It's embroidery. He's poking fun at Judge Bao. A lot of people did that with drama versions of the Judge Bao stories. Others, we don't know where they came from, but they'll have the same formulation about like, this story is a warning against this. And like, there'll be four of them in a row that have that, but none of the other ones in the collection. So it's like he probably transported them wholesale from somewhere else, maybe touched them up a little bit.
Interesting. So what are you guys working on now, Bruce? What do you have on the what irons have ye in the fire?
I'm working on what you might call Ming Dynasty Shanzhai.
Interesting.
Basically, fakes, forgeries, fakes, and especially material objects that were created in the Ming Dynasty that were sold at a high price often, but not only are not fakes of anything really valuable, they had to invent the whole category of object they were. So sort of like when you can go to a market in China and buy a Louis Vuitton pair of jeans or something like
right.
that.
Right, they've never
Louis
made Vuitton, jeans.
Exactly.
Right, right. So what are some of these things, and are there any in museums that we're aware of today, and are you about to disrupt the whole global art market?
I'm trying a little bit. I'm particularly working on this category of things called Shuendo incense burners. That's supposed to be from the early 15th century, but there's no reason to think they actually are. And the...
Like Shuendo, like obscure virtue?
It's actually the reign name, the name of a Ming emperor from the 1420s to 30s. But he actually never made these things, and completely invented in the 16th century and given a backstory about marvelous things that happened in the palace when a temple full of Buddhist statues burned down and turned into this bizarre alloy made out of the gold and copper and silver and jewels that all fused into a new material that he then used to make these vessels.
Fascinating. Wow. I mean, and do you know if there are any Shendelus out there in museums today?
There are thousands and they're all fake.
Oh my God. Interesting. But, you know, I think they have historical value for that very fact anyway, right?
Absolutely.
To rewrite the placard in front of them and then they remain of historical value. Wow. I'd love to follow up with you on that. That sounds fascinating. What about you, Chris? What are you working on these days?
My next book will be one about Chinese film classics. So it's actually about film studies. Some of the best early films that we can still see that were made in China. So they're all black and white films. About half of them are silent films and half are sound films. And I've been kind of studying and teaching film for quite a while. And so returning to that. But my Swindle-related project is, I think, tentatively going to be called China on the Make. Both meaning there are all of these stories about China not just being ambitious, but also being somewhat crafty and deceptive. So I feel like deception and Chinese character keep getting pulled together to tell the China story.
Right. In Donald Trump's mind, for sure. Right.
Definitely. But it's not just him. You know, just the buffoons of the world. But then there's also the story of like, well, what stories do Chinese people tell about deception? So like, how do Chinese people talk about the make? So to speak, because you have these collections of swindle stories from throughout the ages. It's like a major theme in literature, tons of films about it. You mentioned Taiwan. That made me think of a film called Formosa Mambo, where this, you know, law-abiding man gets pulled into one of these scam gangs, and he impersonates a policeman apparently very well because he's so trustworthy looking. But in the last scene, he looks directly at the camera and says, like, I'm going to the mainland. Like, that's my next step.
Breaks the fourth wall and then just...
Exactly. But it's like, you may be next. So China's a land of opportunity. But this is like how the story keeps getting told. And so I want to kind of bring some of these stories out.
Well, my very favorite novel, also written during the Ming, is full of deception and wiles. But, you know, it's stratagems and warfare. But didn't Sun Tzu himself say that deception is the foundation of war, right? Fascinating, yeah. Amazing. The book, again, I highly recommend it to everybody. It's called The Book of Swindles, Selections from a Late Ming Collection. And the translators, again, are Christopher Ray, who is here, and Bruce Rusk. And the author, of course, was Zhang Yingyu. Great. On to recommendations. Let's, before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Sign up for our free daily email newsletter and subscribe to our SubChina Access premium membership program to attend live shows for free, to get deep discounts on our conferences, to join us for live interactive chats with our special guests, and of course to get this podcast ad-free and a few days early each week. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where our handle is @SubChinaNews. So, recommendations. Bruce, why don't you kick us off? What do you have for us?
I'm going to go with a classic, David Maurer's The Big Con. It's from 1940. and it's a sort of scholarly book. He was a linguist, a social linguist, but he spent the 1930s hanging out with con artists.
Wow.
And learning their language and learning their tricks. And it's the book that every 20th century American con artist movie was based on. The Sting, everything David Mamet did about con artists, they all cribbed from him. And so we also use some of his language in figuring out how to translate the terms in Zhang Yingyu's book.
Oh, awesome. Now that sounds great. I have never even heard of this book. So the author again?
Is Maurer, David Maurer, M-A-U-R-E-R.
Maurer. Wow.
And there's a paperback edition easily available.
Well, I'm going to buy that on Amazon right as soon as we're done here. Excellent recommendation. Chris, what do you have for us?
You know, there's a new translation out of a Ming Dynasty story collection, Ling Meng Chu's Slapping the Table in Amazement. This is a collection of about...
Which I'm glad none of you did during this podcast, by the way.
That's right, I mean, but let's all do it now. But it's translated by this amazing pair of translators who had also done Feng Menglong's Sanyan, or story collections, the massive, massive works, like the most important story collections of the Ming Dynasty. And Slapping the Table in Amazement has a lot of fantastic tales of overseas travels, as well as wily, deceptive figures like Lazy Dragon. He's kind of a gentleman thief, and he and his buddies like set up games and contests where the friends will like hang out in a tea house and he'll try to steal something that's on the table right in front of them while they stay up. So they're very entertaining stories and expertly translated. Just came out a couple of months ago.
Who's the translator?
The translators are Shu Huiyang and Yun Qin Yang.
Okay, great, great, great. That's a terrific recommendation. I have a really banal one that I'm going to, for Christmas this year, or it's last year, I got my kids an Oculus Rift. And it wasn't working super well on the old computer that we had originally plugged it into, but recently we got this smoking new computer and we've hooked it up, and it's just unbelievable. I had no idea that VR had advanced this far so quickly. It's really quite compelling. I'm not somebody who's easily, you know, mind blown by technology. I'm around it all the time, but I think they've done a fantastic job. I mean, the controllers and everything. It's an experience. If you haven't already, you know, done it, if you haven't, you know, been in these immersive environments yet, wow. I mean, it's pretty amazing. So Oculus Rift, I mean, they're really quite affordable, and there's so much software for them now that's available. And that too is pretty affordable. So check it out. It's not just for games. I think that it's really going to be a pretty transformative technology down the road. So great. Thanks again once more to you gentlemen, Christopher Ray and Bruce Rusk. And I hope to see you guys back on Seneca soon.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Thank you.
The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews and follow us on Twitter at subchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.